Welcome to this episode of the Erasing Shame Podcast. This is DJ Chuang, and I'm sitting here with Elena Kim. I'm so delighted to have found her as I was just, you know, searching around the internet, because I'm a new kid on the block learning about mental health and how that connects to our Christian faith. There's not much out there at all, because in the mental health world, it's very secular. It's a biological, psychological, and social components that they see as what mental health and wellness looks like. But those of us that are Christians are beginning to figure out ways to integrate our spirituality. And Elena has done some rigorous research in that realm, and we would like to explore what that means and what that, how that helps us, those of us that are just trying to get some help for the confusion and the overwhelming emotion that we're experiencing when it comes to the world of counseling and psychotherapy. Elena, thank you for joining me.
Yes, thank you for having me here, DJ. It's real just honor and privilege to be able to just talk about this. This is definitely my area of passion. I did my research and a lot of my clinical work looking at how do we integrate spirituality, specifically Christianity, into the psychotherapy healing process. What does that look like? And I can definitely go into some more history of psychology and why there's always been such a separation between the two, where the two fields are today. I mean, I'll go ahead and kind of start there. You know, everyone knows Freud is the father of psychology. He always thought that one's religion was a neurosis. It's from a neurotic behavior. He felt like it was from a place of weakness. And so for the first, I want to say, like 100 years of psychology, there was this real exclusion to one's soul and the spiritual aspect of our lives. Interestingly enough, if you looked at statistics maybe 20 years ago of professors or, you know, faculty across universities and their faith, right? Agnostic, atheist, or of religious traditions, psychologists would be the highest in the atheistic belief. And so, I mean, yes, there's a history there. But the good news is that there were a small handful of really brave psychologists who started doing research in this area. First, it was physical health and spirituality. Is there a correlation? And they found, wow, spirituality, religious behavior seems to be correlated to better health benefits. And then they started looking at spirituality and mental health. Is there a relationship between those? So there's actually been like, I want to say like close to 50 years of research now corroborating that is very, that there is a relationship, that there's something there. And so I do feel like the gap between those two fields are slowly merging. And that hopefully through that, a lot of good wisdom can come out of it. So yes, that's
my area. 50 years of research is beginning to find data and the evidence-based connection between the value of spirituality to one's mental health. And I'm beginning to see some of that as a layperson outside of the walls of academia. And so it just takes, decades for some of that to come out of those walls.
You know, it's so funny. One of the founding fathers, I would say, of this research area all had to wait until they hit tenure. And then this would just be a side project. And I want to say as close to like 10 to 15 years ago, you would lose credibility as a faculty member if this was one of your areas of research. And so a lot of these people did it courageously because they believed in it. And even though they knew it would be a ding to their career or like a hit to their career, they did it anyway. And it's those sort of founding fathers that kind of laid the foundation that's now allowed a lot of other people to kind of go into it. So,
that's kind of the thing about pioneers. We do have to take some hits as we blaze new trails.
Yes.
And I know for me as an advocate now, launching Christian Asian Mental Health, I've been invited into secular mental health spaces. Here's the irony of things. So in the secular mental health spaces, they're much more open to the resources of faith than pastors I talk with, and how they are, many of them are still very resistant to the resources of psychology and psychotherapy. It's totally backwards.
I could see that. Yes. I think there's a lot of truth to what you're saying right now.
Yeah. And so as we open the conversation towards, okay, someone who is struggling with some mental health symptoms, emotions are overwhelming, it's affecting their daily functioning. Mm-hmm. It's really challenging for someone who doesn't have any counseling background, part of it because of our shame-based cultures in as Asian Americans, that there's different kinds of counseling, like biblical counseling, Christian counseling, just basic counseling that's available through our health insurance providers network. And then now there's app-based solutions, there's life coaching, and all of these things. And so it's like a jungle. So Elena, may I ask you to help us wade through some of that so people can get the help they need?
I will, again, these are my personal opinions. You know, I hope people can, you know, take the parts that they feel like are helpful. I can see why the two camps, let's just say, have some resistance towards each other. I can understand what both camps are trying to say. So on the one hand, the more biblical counseling or pastoral counseling camps are trying to say, hey, all of these sort of techniques and interventions and ways of healing that you've come up with or like developed over all these years has not paid any attention to the soul or the source of this divine God and his love and his power. And as a result, basically what they're saying is, we don't agree with your worldview. And the worldview that you bring in as a therapist is going to impact your client, right? And so they're I think they're essentially making a comment about the worldview that the therapist is bringing in. Now, on the side of, you know, the camp of, let's say, secular psychologists or those that are trained, there, you know, there's a lot of wisdom that I believe that the field of psychology has also accumulated over the past 150 years. And one of which I'm going to caveat this by saying not all camps within psychology would agree with this view that I'm about to say, which is the importance of emotional affect. We call it affect, the ability for your body, your mind to experience some of these emotions of sadness and depression or grief to love, joy, and peace. And so the field of psychology has, I think, has done an amazing job in looking at that and knowing how to become skilled at accessing that in their clients and what the emotional process of healing tends to look like. I believe there's a lot of good insight there. And so I as a result, I feel like both camps are kind of saying the same thing. So let me try to say, if you're looking at a counselor, a secular counselor, and lots of times psychologists or, you know, secular therapists will say, well, it's important that I don't impose on my client. And so therefore, I'm not going to lead them. And that's what they disagree with when it comes to some of those biblical counseling models. However, my direct comment to secular therapists would be, would you not agree, though, that your worldview matters? And so what would be considered ethical in the secular space is the conversation about what we call therapeutic orientation. Most people say, I'm either, you know, more CBT or I'm more psychodynamic. They're kind of like two camps, right? And if you get a client that comes into you saying, I really want CBT sort of interventions and that's how I really want my therapy to go, but I'm psychodynamic, it's actually in our world considered ethical to say, hey, I actually don't work that way. Those are not the therapeutic tools that I use. Perhaps somebody else might be a better fit. So we believe that's the right thing to do. But then let's say a client comes to us and says, I really want spirituality to be part of my therapeutic process. And then I say, well, you know, there can be a lot of therapists that say, and let's say the client asks me, what's your spiritual worldview? A lot of therapists would say, you're not supposed to reveal that. You're not supposed to talk about that. But then how can we talk about theoretical orientation and say that's ethical, but then not talk about our spiritual worldview when the client is asking for spirituality to be a part of this process? And so I think it's important to note that you know, I'm going to go out there and say this. Every therapist has assumptions about what the healing process looks like. It could either be through their training or their years of clinical experience. But what we call it sometimes theoretical orientation. We call it, what's your clinical arc? What's your therapeutic arc? Which basically means, how do you think healing happens? We all have it. And those are all the ways in which we're going to be using it in our therapy.
Okay, so if you can translate all of those technical terms into a normal person, how would a normal person describe their worldview, theoretical orientation, frame of mind? What's a normal person's term that they would use? Because, hey, they're just desperate for help. And so what would be a good question to, like, maybe one or two or three assessment questions to say, where are you coming from? I think another way that I know some in New York would say, what do you find your root identity in? I mean, I know it's way complicated, but if we can just demystify some of that language into something that's more accessible, that would help us to say, okay, here's the kind of counselor you might want to steer towards, because they're all going to try to persuade you to what they have to offer because they're selling a service. At least that's the way a layperson would look at, because that's my family orientation. I grew up in a traditional Chinese family. They resisted counseling because, oh, they're just trying to sell you services. So there was that default suspicion and resistance to getting professional help. And yet, here I was suffering, but I had that resistance. So help me break that ice.
I think the first question to ask, so if you are approaching somebody who's been trained secularly or clinically, right? The first question, just ask them and say, hey, my spiritual religious belief and experiences have always been important to me. That is a big part of who I am. And it's what I've used for guidance, comfort, healing. Is that something you're comfortable with using in this process with me? Right. That's just the first question. Will you be willing to work with me in this way? If they say yes, then I think it's fair to ask them, tell me, what's your spiritual religious worldview? Like, how do you envision spiritual healing to be a part? How does that look? How does that unfold to you? And so, you know, obviously they're not going to get into too many specifics, because they want you to experience your own unique spiritual walk with God. And by giving you something so prescribed, can already sort of circumvent the whole process, because now you're trying to fit in, you know, fit into this prescribed way of being. And that's, you know, we can talk about the other side of the camp, but, you know, if they can sort of describe it in a way that makes you feel like, yes, I feel like this person is going to be able to use the religious and spiritual beliefs and experiences that I've had and incorporate it comfortably and confidently in this counseling process, I think that's a good sign, right? So that's this side of the camp. Then you've got this side of the camp, where you have a lot of, I kind of bucket, you know, really a spectrum, to be honest with you, but, you know, this side of the camp where it's more heavily emphasized the sort of truths of Christianity and the doctrines of Christianity. And why the secular or clinical side, I don't know what to call this side, could be resistant on the other side has to do with, I believe, access to emotions. So there's been, fortunately, a lot of good research coming out in the past couple decades that talks about our brain and the neurotransmitters and the plasticity of our brain. And as a result, the connection of our thoughts and brain and our body to emotions, they're all connected. And so what we're realizing is that to have a deeply transformative experience, it needs to go beyond just the thought processes, but it needs to be at a place where when you're done with that experience, your knee-jerk reactions, your intuition, your compulsions change. That's what's changing. It's not just a pause, let me take a step back and view this differently and then try to implant different thoughts into my head so I can be, no, it's literally an event happens and all of a sudden, instead of fear, anger, etc., just comes out of our hearts. It's peace, joy, curiosity, understanding. It's living in a place where prior you might have been living in fear or scarcity, but then afterwards you're actually living in plentiful resources, love, and patience. That's the sort of transformation we're looking for. And if you want that sort of transformation, it's not just in your head. It's not just the thoughts going through your head. And so one of the really, I think, important ways to access that level of change is to get into one's emotional responses and reactions. And so unfortunately, when you spend too much time with knowledge of way that the way things need to be, there can be a lack of training or focus on the emotional experience of the person that you're with. And the other difficulty is that we are all humans. And so performance is always a part of our psyche, right? We're always thinking, we need to do this. I was wrong, so I got to do this so that I can become right. And if you give too many directives, that's the part of the person that's getting triggered. And so they're just trying to cover up their behavior by doing what they're supposed to be told to be doing. And so as a therapist who's skilled to really notice people's emotions, we're trained to kind of notice, oh, that person started to get a little emotional exactly on this part of the story. I'm going to have to come back to that another time. And then next time they do it, we kind of like ask them to, let's pause and actually, can we stop right there? And then you'll notice at times when you might offer a suggestion in that moment and they pop out of the emotion and they're back into their heads again. And you're just like, all right, that was messed up on my part. So in that sense, I feel like a lot of years of clinical training kind of helps hone that skill. And so I think the art, or what I would say really where the spirit moves and works, is when you're able to bring somebody to this real deep, vulnerable emotion of helplessness and asking God, I can't do this. Please help me. And then as a therapist, still encouraging the Holy Spirit to enter into the room and into that conversation and have space for the Holy Spirit to do their work. That, I think, is where the magic is. And that's where the transformation is. And that's where the healing is. And so I think that's what a lot of the biblical and pastoral counselors are stressing. You're not allowing for the Holy Spirit to get in there and do its job. And so I really think you need both. I think you need the wisdom of Christ and the truth of what the Spirit can do in our lives. And at the same time, I do think you need the sort of training and skills to help that individual peel back slowly all of their layers and then get to a place of being like a child and asking God for help. So I think that's, so when you're asking about how do we look for help, you know, I would try to look for both. You know, I think, you know, I told you about the questions to ask a counselor, but then if you're approaching somebody with more of a pastoral counseling or biblical counseling, that sort of lens, it's just to ask them about their experience and training in working with emotions and the ability to refrain from giving directives, but really helping us to be naked in front of God, right? That's really what we need to get to. And so that's the combination in the middle ground that I think, to be honest with you, is really hard to find. I think that training right now that exists today is either this way or this way. There's not a lot of training that does this in the middle. And to be frank, I think that's the case for just about any orientation, any type of therapy out there. I think this middle ground is pretty hard to find, but I think it's doable. And so, I don't know. That's kind of a nebulous way of answering your question. I don't know if there are more areas in which I can kind of provide more details.
Well, this is all new ground. And so we're all trying to figure out how to sort through the complexities and the histories and the different frameworks and the models of providing professionals, providing the expertise to guide someone towards their healing path. And so there's the side of the professionals, and there's also the side of the individual. Each person has their own story and their own shape from nature and nurture and life experiences. And for some people, a biblical counseling where it's very theologically driven framework works well. Whereas others work much better in an unstructured environment, spiritually speaking, where it's secular, because their deep-rooted issue are much more from life experiences of trauma and things in the tangible world that don't seem to have as much spiritual reference. And they need to work through that before they can integrate their spiritual life. And then there's people that just are not interested in the spiritual thing, but that was imposed on them because of their family origin or whatever else. And we want to respect the autonomy and the agency of the person to guide their own healing. So the analogy that came up with in some of the secular gatherings I've been to is just like pharmaceuticals and medication are helpful for many people, they also have side effects. And so whichever orientation or framework a professional comes with, it may have side effects for the person, and it really takes that. I mean, it's already really hard for the person to reach out for help and then to do the hard work of their healing journey. And so to have the awareness of when they are being triggered or when they're experiencing side effects from a counseling relationship, boy, that's just something to be aware of, and it's hard. And so as I try to think of a way to simplify, at least to give people some easy help here, is in finding a counselor that works well with you, it's one of the key questions, as I oversimplify, so I want to say that I'm oversimplifying that, do you feel safe and comfortable talking with that person about your most vulnerable things? And if your emotional reaction is just like, boy, it's so hard to explain myself. It's so hard to explain myself with my Asian American experiences with someone who's not Asian, then you don't need to be working harder trying to open up when you're trying to get help. And I think for a layperson, that seems to be a helpful point of reference. It takes some time to find the right counselor.
So actually, you bring up a really good point. So back in the day, when there was like a big debate between cognitive behavioral therapies and psychodynamic therapies, they ran a whole bunch of studies to see which one is more effective. And what was so interesting was both were. The key difference was what we call, like you're saying, connection. They found that connection was by far the strongest indicator as to whether or not therapy would go well than which orientation you're using. You know, in that connection, we're talking a sense of safety. You know, does my therapist get me? Are we on the same page in terms of where we want to go with this work? And so that is extremely important. And what you're absolutely right in that each individual is different. And, you know, if I want to put on the Asian American lens in terms of mental health, we, you know, I'll speak for Korean Americans, and I think this is also largely the case for a lot of East Asian Americans as well. It's just we grew up in a household, in a culture where we had an authoritative or maybe even authoritarian sort of figure, and we didn't question authority, we obeyed it. And so oftentimes, here I am trained in Western psychology, and I'll get an Asian American, and you can tell like what they want homework, they want structure. And one of the things that we've discovered, there's been a lot of work now done on what does multicultural competency look like. And we had, there's been a lot of acknowledgement that, this is new territory for them. They've never received therapy. They're not sure what it's about. And they will feel safe if I can actually put a little bit of structure around it and give them some homework and kind of explain what's the process going to look like. And in the past, a lot of Western psychoanalytic school of thought, like that's like Freud's land, would have said, you never talk about that stuff. But in order to honor the worldview and the cultural context in which these Asian Americans are walking into our rooms with, we have to do that. And so you're absolutely right in that there is a cultural component when working with Asian Americans on top of the Christian spiritual component as well. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's draw from some of your expertise as you're doing this research. How do you bring the two worlds together so that we bring the best of our understanding and expertise to help clients in their healing journey?
How do we bring together, you're saying, our Asian American cultural background with the spiritual Christian sort of worldview and lens and theology?
As well as psychotherapy, because your research and your work is integration of spirituality and psychology.
Well, that's a big question. I bet somebody could write
a
thick book about that.
And that's what you're working on.
With the Asian American context, the culture that we live in, I think that having an authoritative figure is important to us. I think it's really hard for us to disassociate, to kind of not have that. I think it's really difficult. And so as a result, you know, I think it's great because it allows us to kind of allow God, Jesus, you know, the spirit to be in that, to speak to us in that way. And so I think in a lot of ways, I feel lucky as an Asian American that we're kind of easy. It's easy for us to kind of have that sort of relationship with God. That being said, I think that if we were to also incorporate our identity as Christians, I'm going to bring in another concept that might be a little bit nebulous, but I wanted to bring in this existential thing. So there's this whole other view in psychology called existential psychotherapy. And it's actually written by, he's still alive, probably the most famous psychologist alive today is Irvin Yalom. And he wrote a book about this, and he talks about death anxiety, and he talks that we are all operating at a very unconscious level. We're unaware of how much death anxiety we have. And so he kind of breaks the different facets of death anxiety down. You know, I'll give you one example, which he calls it existential loneliness. Like when you get to a place where you have to face death, it's so lonely. Only you can walk through that door by yourself. Nobody else can walk through that door with you. And so it's so scary. And so out of this fear, this unconscious underneath, right, fear of loneliness, we may be operating at a place where we're seeking approval and wanting to have friends, and rejection is, it can, you know, create a panic attack. Like, so in his view, we are so scared of death that all, he believes that all sources of mental illness are birthed from the subconscious view, the subconscious fear of death. So to bring that into the equation, right, where as a Christian, what does it mean to really have confidence in the fact that God has conquered death, right? Like, you know, it's getting deep into our souls and believing that when we walk through that door of death, we're not lonely, that God is actually there, that Jesus is actually by our side. Now, but to believe it here and to believe it here are two very different things. And I think it takes a lifelong journey to get it to here, to be honest. But that's just the many facets of it. And so when you ask me about how to incorporate Christianity in our worldview into this therapeutic process, it's actually accessing, being honest with how we are all running around like chickens without a head, trying to avoid death or the reality of it. And to what extent are we really inviting Christ and all the promises that he's given us into that conversation? And so that's what I see would be the ultimate long-term, honestly, not even goal of therapy, just goal of life, right? And so that's the sort of Christian lens and view that I bring into the therapeutic process, is helping them uncover that some of these questions that we are running from, you're right, we can't answer it. Only God can answer it. Yeah. And let's allow God to speak into that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's helpful. That is powerful for those of us that are people of faith, it really comes down to how God, who is the ultimate resource, the creator God who knows us inside out, really is the healer mm-hmm. of our soul and our being and everything. And I think you, when we talked previously, you also mentioned there were three things that we need to understand about who God is that is most transformative in helping us bring all the head knowledge down into our heart and change yes. us from the inside out. Can yes. you share those three characteristics?
Absolutely. What I've found, so when I talk about these existential wounds or pains that we bring to God, let's do loneliness as an example. Mm-hmm. And let's say there was a traumatic event in your life and you're still triggered by it. You're getting panic attacks or anxiety by it. And you finally, we peel away all the layers, you're in pain, and you want to say to God, where the heck were you? Where mm-hmm. were you? You were not there. I think we have to have the audacity of hope that these three things about God are real. And if we can have hope in these three things, I genuinely believe it's that leap of faith that allows the Spirit, it opens our heart to allow the Spirit to come in and do its work, which is one, God is loving. He is loving and good. He is so loving. Two, he's powerful, right? He has the ability to conquer this existential anxiety that you have. And then third, it's that he's so intimate. He is by your side. He is your lifelong partner and companion. And so I genuinely believe that. I'm so appreciative of the life of Jesus. If Jesus never existed, I think it'd be really hard for us to believe that God can be intimate. I think it's very mm-hmm. hard. But the life of Jesus gives us this beautiful story and examples of how him walking by our side and loving us and caring for us and wanting to be intimate with all of us, I think allows for us to have those three pillars of belief. And so I do believe that those things are necessary to have that intimate experience with the Spirit.
Wow. That is so good. That is so grounding. That is so freeing. And it's a great note to close on. So thank you for sharing all that you shared with us in the past half an hour. Elena, it's been great chatting with you. And I hope thank to stay you. Connected in the months and years ahead. Good luck on your research.
No, thank you. Thanks for having me here.
Thank you. And thank you for listening to this episode of the Erasing Shame podcast. Stay connected with us at erasingshame.com and subscribe wherever you listen to the podcast. Have a great day, great evening, wherever you are. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Erasing Shame podcast. Check out the show notes at erasingshame.com and subscribe to our email for updates. We would love to hear from you, so please add your comments at our website or on social. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any podcast app, and you can also subscribe on YouTube or follow on Facebook. Please add a rating and review so we can reach more people with our message of health, hope, and compassion. This podcast is the digital outreach of Christian Asia Mental Health.